This program is brought to you by the Ford Hall Forum at Suffolk University. Please visit us at fordhallforum.org.
A question for Professor Goldman. I was hoping you could comment on, you spoke a lot about the gains and strength of the in the economy with relation to oil and gas. I was hoping you could comment on gaining strength in other sectors, or maybe a lack thereof, besides oil and gas.
Well, that's part of the problem, that because the gas and the oil sectors bring them so much money, it makes the ruble strong, that their domestic manufacturing is in serious shape. I've got to be careful about that. Overall, manufacturing is weak. But because there's also all this income coming in from disposable income, this attracts foreign manufacturers, so that they're now beginning to attract automobile manufacturers from almost every major manufacturer in the world. Ford is there, General Motors is there, Chrysler is considering, Toyota is there, so that you begin to do that. And when you start manufacturing, even though if you're assembling kits that are brought in from overseas, you begin to attract parts manufacturing. So to some extent, there's this beginning of an automobile industry that depends on foreign manufacturers. But overall, it's still cheaper to import. They sell more imported cars, almost like, I guess, the United States, you could say, than they sell domestically made cars now. So this it's weak. But one of the things that's intriguing, however, is that agriculture is now beginning to recover. After all, Russia, prior to the revolution, was, with the United States, the world's largest exporter of grain. And now they're beginning to export grain again, which is a bit intriguing. Nothing as yet to become a rival Australia or the United States, but at least there does seem to be some recovery. The strongest sector, of course, is the service sector, where this is the kinds of things that we do in the United States. And again, that's because of the disposable income is there. Unemployment is quite low, and that's quite an unusual thing to see, but that's partly because it's beginning to trickle down. I should also say just one other thing. I don't mean to say that everybody's living a very high life. You have this very disproportionate distribution of income. There are now 53 oligarchs listed in Forbes magazine of billionaires. There are 53 billionaires now in Russia. Yet you do have a very large percentage of the population below the poverty line, although Putin is proud of the fact. The last time we were with him, somebody asked him, what is one of your greatest accomplishments? And he said, reducing the number of people below the poverty line from 33% when I took over office to 17%. And that's, again, a constant. You can do it if you've got the oil and the gas. So it comes right back again to that oil and gas.
I guess we'll start here on the line. Yes, sir.
Good evening. My name is Alexander Rasolimo. I'm president of the Center for Security and Social Progress, a think tank. My question is only very remotely connected with energy, but it touches tangentially upon one of the oligarchs, Khodorkovsky. Like many people in the audience, I believe I've been following with fascination and some disbelief the Litvinenko saga and the murder of this former KGB person in London by polonium. So my question is, what can you tell us about the Litvinenko affair that did not appear in the Boston Globe or the New York Times?
I can tell you nothing about the details. I don't know them, and I'm not likely to find them out. But there is one aspect, and it shows the growing self-assertion, I would go further, shamelessness, of the what is called the Siloviki, the power people in Russia, meaning particularly FSB and the other secret services. Their numbers have not been reduced, unlike the armed forces, whose numbers are shrinking. And now their posturing on the international scene. This is not the only case. There has been a questionable attempt on an American journalist who was on one of the programs that discussed this particular affair. And a week later, he was shot at. We don't know by whom. I'm not a great believer in coincidences. But there is a growing self-assertion, shamelessness, saying, we are doing what we want to do, and what are you going to do about it? To some extent, the Putin speech in Munich, to which my colleague referred, had a little bit of that as well. And the Secretary of Defense, with great restraint, said something to the effect of, let's not start another Cold War. But the tone is aggressive, and with no attempt at all to carry some kind of rapprochement with it. This is completely different from the first few years of the Yeltsin regime, when he, and particularly his foreign minister, went out of the way, although in Yeltsin's case, it was never a straightforward path, it was up and down, but still, to create a brand new relationship. That is not the case anymore.
I would go along with what Yuri said. You know, in Ukraine, we do have a tape where Kuchma, who was then the president, ordered the assassination of a journalist who was very critical of the state. We do have that. Some people have asked, do you think Putin gave the order to have Litvinenko assassinated? I don't know. Like Yuri, I haven't sat in on the meetings, and I'm not taping what's going on in the Kremlin. I would be doubtful, however, but I don't think it's necessary, because I think the point that Yuri made was the important one, is that under Putin, he has brought in a lot of his comrades from the KGB, and you know, we're in charge. And you don't have to give an order, somebody's making trouble for you. Just somebody decides, I'll take some initiative and I'll just do away with him. It's a very murky business, because Litvinenko claimed he had some secret information about all kinds of personal murder of other journalists. And you know, if you watch what's going on in Russia, it's not just this Litvinenko who was assassinated, but there have been a whole series of journalists, almost one a week, and for all kinds of reasons. And this is, in a sense, a return to lawlessness that marked the Yeltsin period, which seemed to diminish for a while. But if you know, if you're in charge, nobody's watching. Let's go ahead and do this. But Putin is clearly very upset by all these things, because he knows that it reflects badly, and he does want to show that Russia is a place that where there is control and order. But this goes against him. So, in answer to your question, we don't know.
If I may,
thank you very much.
There is one other point, and that is Putin himself has created an aura, an atmosphere. Before he became president, when he was already on the way to power, he went with his colleagues to celebrate the 21st of December, Stalin's birthday. That tells you a hell of a lot. He restored the old flag to the armed forces, red flag with the star. He restored a certain plaque at the Lubyanka, the headquarters of the secret services. That tells you something. The population is very quick, particularly in Russia, to take up signals, to understand little body movements, and to interpret them into action. So it's almost irrelevant whether he personally gave the order or not. I agree with my colleague.
Let me just add that one of the other things that Putin said, which is a reflection of what Yuri said, is that Putin has said that one of the greatest catastrophes of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union, which, if you believe in great power, that would be the case. It's also true if you look, there's a very interesting book, if you're interested in reading, called First Person, which is in English as well as Russian. And it's a series of interviews with people around Putin, his wife, some of his people he worked with, and even some with him. And he describes how during the collapse of the Berlin Wall, when the Berlin Wall was turned down, he was in East Germany as a KGB agent, and how it really, the world seemed to disintegrate around him and how upsetting this was to him. It really was quite a strong feeling on his part. Also, I should just one other thing, and I'll be quiet, but when the invasion of Czechoslovakia took place during the Prague Spring, this also is in the book. That's when he went to volunteer to become a member of the KGB. He was only in high school then, a 10-year school, and they told him, no, don't call us, we'll call you. But he, you know, this was an unusual time to want to join the KGB.
If I may, one more point. You may ask, why did the collapse of another totalitarian state, indeed almost an empire, Nazi Germany, not bring about similar symptoms? In the German case, there was total military defeat and occupation. And thereafter, no one asked any questions. We went to war, we were defeated, the regime was exterminated, and that was the end of it. That never happened in Russia. Russia wasn't defeated, it wasn't occupied, and yet it lost an empire. And so there is a sense of almost paranoia. Somebody did us in. How come that we were a superpower, and look at us today, even with the advances economically that have occurred under Putin? And he shares that particular paranoia. Somebody tried to do us in, and therefore we owe the world some kind of retribution. This is a very strong psychological factor.
Gentlemen, this is almost an extension of the previous question, because I myself have been intrigued to watch Russia, you know, since the collapse, especially with regard to the possibility of developing a democracy. And I guess my question basically is, how do you get from here there? And because certainly, to me, you know, one of the most obvious signs is actually, Professor Goldman, what you were talking about, how every week one of the journalists who does actually speak out the truth in Chechnya or wherever gets hit. If the press is not free, how is the whole process going to begin and move in the direction of democracy?
If I may, it took Great Britain 7 centuries for Magna Carta to democracy. And Great Britain, even in the time of Elizabeth, was a police state, not a very pleasant one. There is no imminent vision of such a development in Russia. In part, the good guys are to blame. The Democrats, pitiful as their numbers may be, are totally incapable of getting their act together. Time and again, the two major organizations, Yabloko under Yavlinsky and SPS under various other leaders, have asked to join forces because otherwise they cannot pass the parliamentary threshold, the minimum number of votes to get seats. They have never been able to join forces. And what is happening is that many of the so-called Democrats are living almost as if they were emigres, as if they had left the Soviet Union and were living in exile. Because in exile, what happens? You get 4 persons and 15 parties. They start to dematerialize, so to speak. And they are behaving as if they were exiles in Russia. They seem to have lost any sense politically of what you must do in order to prevail. The result has been that Putin and others are playing them off against each other. Very recently, one of his entourage said, "We will never permit Yabloko to get anywhere into parliament. But SPS, we might." Why? Yabloko participated in a demonstration under the former chess master Kasparov. SPS didn't. So the decision was made. Those who didn't participate in a demonstration against the regime will be nice to them. And that kind of tactic seems to work.
You know, the question you ask is probably the most profound that we think about. You think about the United States. Actually, Yuri and I were talking about this before the session. It's, you know, you can have a not just a lecture, or but you can't answer it really in a short way. I've thought a lot about it, and I last night we went to a lecture at Boston University by Bernard Bailyn about the American Constitution, and you start thinking about it. And you start thinking how lucky we are to have a bunch of people, who, you know, all of us were migrants, or our ancestors were migrants, come to this country and very often from countries that did not have democracy and yet still ended up with this Constitution, which even now is under threat in some, to some extent. But it works, and it did division of balance of power checks and balances and all this. And I thought a lot about that. I went back and read the Federalist Papers, which is a good thing to do every once in a while, just to appreciate how these farmers or these petty bourgeoisie in this, you know, it's a good question to ask in this room, managed to come up with this document. Why can't they do something like that in Russia? Why didn't they do something like that in Russia? Well, the history is very different. And the Russians, you know, are very comfortable with Putin. I mean, we may be concerned about Putin, but 80% of the population really supports him. And there's a very strong movement, as Yuri suggested, that he stay in office, that he not give up next year at this time. So how do you get it? I was asked, you know, give us some advice, actually, for the U.S. AID, our foreign aid group. And my suggestion was this, and it had a political component to it, and that is that we, as an American government, when we were providing them with foreign aid, now we don't, they're too rich, we don't need to do that. But what we should try to do, and what would be useful to do, is to encourage them, and this may be Marxist an approach, but to encourage them to set up small business, to set up small farms, private farms. If you look at the United States, and this is one of the things I worry about, is we go more and more concentrated. Bank of America, you know, there go the small banks. What you need to do is have a lot of petty bourgeoisie who have a vested interest in their property. That, you know, the Magna Carta in a will, although they weren't petty bourgeoisie when they, but they wanted to stake out their rights, and they wanted to put limits on what the king, the leader, could do. And restrain them. And to the extent that you get people who have their own property, who are independent, who aren't government employees, or working for companies that are owned by the government, you're more likely to have that. It's no guarantee, but you're more likely to have that. And so, actually, our government has now had a program where we were giving loans to startups just for that reason. Now, that's a very simple answer, but it's, you know, it's, at least it's a response. It's a first step in a response this way, that if you get enough people, one of the problems in Russia right now, if you get enough people who have their own interests, they'll fight. One of the problems right now in Russia is that only 10 to 15% of the GDP comes from small independent businesses in Russia. In the United States, it's over 50%. And what I worry about is we shrink and that we may come under the same kind of problems. But at least that's one way of looking at it.
My question is a two-phase one. The first phase mainly towards Professor Goldman, and the second towards your colleague. What if there were a worldwide recession, which lasted for, say, 2 years, with oil falling to $35 a barrel? How would that influence Russia's newfound standing? And then Secondly, if that recession should begin during 2007, how might that affect the succession in Russia in 2008?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch what
you said. How would that affect the election if there was a recession? Well, there are people who say, look at this, this high oil price was due to kind of speculators, and it's just a temporary blip, and it, the price will go down, and the Russian budget people actually now are basing their budget on oil at $50 a barrel or $52 a barrel. So far for Russia, they've built up this big war chest of money so that it'll carry them. They build a stabilization fund to their credit, like Norway has, trying to hold down inflation, trying to put monies aside with the idea, like a rainy day fund of the sort we sometimes have in Massachusetts, except it rains here more often than or at least the State House always thinks it's raining. But so they could do that. But my own feeling is that it's unlikely to happen that oil prices will fall that much, even if we have a recession. Now, the only reassurance you can get from that statement, I've predicted that several times in the past. Every time I say oil prices will never drop, immediately they drop. So maybe, you know, good luck for all of us this way. But what is different this time is that there's China and India out there as consumers, and they would have to suffer enormous recession as well. And at this point, it's hard to see it, but it's always hard to see a catastrophe just before it happens. But so I don't think it's going to happen. But if I don't think it'll be that bad for Russia at this point because of this rainy day fund they've built up.
Yeah, first of all, we have to assume that there will be elections. Any one of the intrigues that I have mentioned is more than possible. It's quite likely. Secondly, if the elections are held, there's no question, the polls are quite accurate. 70-80% will follow the central line that represents Putin. But make no mistake about it, it's a passive support, not an enthusiastic one. People now can live, they can look after their families. The standard of living isn't great, but it's not bad. They want to be left alone. They have stopped caring about government. It's no longer of importance to them. So passively, they will flock to the polls and do more or less what the polls say. I don't think you will have to forge the outcome. It's likely to be genuine. What is totally lacking is the ability and the will to organize in any form, never mind politically. In this country, if God forbid there were to be a repetition of September the 11th and Washington were wiped out, you know what would happen next day? Every town and village and farm would be functioning as before. PTA, the Kiwanis, the Rotaries, the Lions, you name it. We are a highly self-organized people. They would run the show. There is no such self-organization in Russia. It's completely lacking. This is what I was trying to refer to. That's what a civil society would have. It hasn't yet blossomed. I have no idea how long it will take. I can only look back upon history and say how long it has taken many Western societies to produce that. And we have to remember how young and how few are the democratic societies on the face of this planet. Somewhere in excess of 75-80% of the world's population lives under tyrannical regimes in societies which are far removed from the 21st century. And it's only a handful that do. United States, Britain, a few West European countries, the newest members of NATO, very much so Poland, the Czech Republic, and I rapidly run out of names. So we have to remember that it's a recent phenomenon. We are a little over 2 centuries old. Many of the West European democracies are not even that old. We're a minority, and we are young. It may take a long time for the rest of the world.
Thank you.
Good evening, gentlemen. I think I have a chess question for both of you. Russia is known for consummate chess players, and Mr. Putin perhaps appears to be one. I grew up, and I think many of us in this room did, during the time of George Kennan and Mr. Ball. Do we, and do Western nations, or are we taking our foreign service, our ambassadorships, seriously? And do we have people in office in the pipeline who are dealing politically in a sensible fashion with nations with whom we need to deal now and in the future, including Russia?
Well, let me try not to be cynical. It's going to be difficult. Are the things I have said well known in Washington? Of course they are. Why are they not mentioned? If you were the administration and you have Iraq, North Korea, Iran, the Middle East, some really vacillating allies in Europe, France, Italy, at least the social democratic part of the German coalition, would you want to open a new front? No. And that's why you have such loud silence about developments in Russia as far as the administration is concerned. I can understand it, but I know it's not based on ignorance. It's based on a deliberate avoidance of facing the facts.
Well, let me take a slightly happier tone to that. I'm impressed with the people in our Foreign Service, if that's what you're asking about specifically. The people in Moscow, the ambassadors in Moscow, have been very well trained. Many of them speak Russian. The embassy staff almost all speaks Russian, knows Russian, has studied the country. Until recently, anyway, the main person in Washington who was dealing with Russian affairs, a man by the name of Tom Graham, was very well informed and very bright. And George Bush, I think, relied on him because Condoleezza Rice relied on Tom Graham, and Condoleezza Rice was trained as a Sovietologist in arms control. So I think the people are there. I think they understand. I think they work hard. I have enormous respect for them. But if you've got, as Yuri said, you're fighting a war, that's what becomes the major concern. I also have to say this, and I alluded to it in my talk, that I think American-Russian relations would be much worse were it not for this bond, and it is a bond between Putin and Bush. Whether that's good or bad, you may pick your choice. I think it's good that there is the bond, because I think the constituencies in both countries would be much more hostile to each other than would otherwise be the case, and I don't think we need that much hostility. I don't mean to say everything could be pushed aside underneath the rug and forgotten. We're not fighting ideological wars anymore, but we are fighting, balance of power wars. And I must say, we've been very provocative. This whole thing, the speech that I read about that Putin gave in Munich, where NATO broke its word, just simple as that. And so you have to have a crisis of confidence in. Well, you make promises and then don't adhere to them. That's not to say the Russians don't make promises and hold to them or break them, but it's American-Russian relations now are not in the forefront of everybody's thinking, as Yuri suggested. So you've got to work within that context.
This program was brought to you by the Ford Hall Forum at Suffolk University. Please visit us at fordhallforum.org.